How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Andrew Mullaney. He's the ex-co-founder and CTO of NewsWhip, and his new company could be about to transform financial markets and the world as we know it. That is a big statement, and I do not make it lightly. He is the founder of Premind AI. This aims to predict what's going to happen in the stock market before humans can even process that information. This could be transformational for the world. Here's my chat with Andrew. Andrew, welcome to the pod.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Beaming in live from London.
That's it.
I gotta say, if you're not watching on YouTube, you gotta go to YouTube and check out the exceptional artwork behind Andrew. What is that?
It was deliberate. It was deliberate. That's why I changed. I'll show you my setup here. It's a real home setup, but yeah, we call it the power picture. It just sits in the background. It's where our desk is. This is not as good a room when you look around it. There's a baby changing unit over there. There's a few toys over there and some laundry drying there. But this picture, yeah, it's just a bit nuts. And why would you gray out the background? Like,
I love it.
I challenge people to figure out how many faces are in it. That's just going to drive you mental.
It's all I'll be able to concentrate now for the rest of the pod. It's class. I like it. I tore down my studio on Saturday and then I rebuilt it this morning. So I'm like, I've got a pod today and I didn't get a chance to build a new studio. So I was like, right, so this is a temporary setup. So you're showing me up. Welcome to the pod. What do you do?
I'm CTO of Premind and we provide technology to understand the inherent behaviors and reactions to information in the stock market.
That's a sexy title. I like it. And most importantly, to point out, you were doing AI before it was cool.
Yeah, way before it was cool. Back when people were on crypto.
Well, that's like four hype cycles ago.
I know. I just couldn't get it. I was just like, you know, we were pitching so many people and they were just like, why don't you use it for crypto? I'm like, because you know crypto is just bullshit. Like, just don't look me in the face and tell me this is for real. And then eventually it just all collapsed. But I mean, like, it's kind of going through resurgence now. But I mean, it just doesn't have the usage. So yeah, no, we were doing AI before it was cool.
And
it's been a long journey, actually.
Yeah, bring me back to that point, actually. We'll go way back in the journey in a while with NewsWhip. People will probably remember you from that. But bring me back to the start of Premind, because like you said there, obviously now everyone's .ai, but bring me back to like the start of Premind. What was the idea, the initial conception?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was in NewsWhip, we were building technology to monitor how news went viral on social media. And we had very sophisticated algorithms and very sophisticated systems to gather news really quickly and gather huge amounts of data and model how this was traversing through social media. And I gained an understanding not only of the technology systems but of what type of content and how we can kind of measure and what type of content is going to have impact with groups of people. And it led me to think, and some people had, or some investors were saying, you know, could you get this to run the stock market, you know? And fundamentally it's the same concept, which is, you know, content that has impact, you know, can be measured. In one case, it was in social media, and in the other case, it was in the stock market. But there's a couple of advantages. Obviously, with the stock market, it's a huge market. Mm. It's extremely valuable. So that was something that drew me to it. And also, it's inherently numerical. So the outcomes, how you're doing, if you're doing it well, can be measured empirically. And I think that's important. And I think that's also important for AI systems, because that's how you can train them to be better. Whereas things that are a bit more nebulous, things that are a bit more difficult, like, say, detecting fake news, or, you know, something that could be potentially somewhat opinionated, is harder.
And it's getting harder, because I think when Trump coined it way back in the day, you know, it kind of was a little bit more black and white, you know, you're able to kind of like verify. But now there's just, I don't know whether it's, you might be able to give me some insight here in terms of, is it the torrent of information that's so hard to decipher, or are the waters just, is there less like credibility from like mainstream media? Why is it getting so difficult?
I don't think it has actually changed that much in terms of, there are empirical facts which just cannot be debated, although people do debate them.
Yeah, things that's
like
the thing.
The world is round or something like that. You know, please don't shoot me, whoever's listening, for saying that. But, you know, I do think there's empirical facts. I haven't checked my... Actually, well, I kind of have checked that the world is round. I've gone around it twice. And even still, while I was going around it, I met a guy who was a flat earther. And he was a smart guy. He was an engineer. And he goes, I don't believe the world is round. And I was like, you know, this is really interesting because I'm on a world trip right now. This was just after I finished up in Newswhip. And I was like, you know, I left Dublin. I went to Berlin. And then I went to Australia. And then I went to China. And now I'm in Costa Rica. And I hope, if I continue flying, that I'll end up back where I started. And he goes, yeah, I know. You just flew around in a circle on top of a flat earth. I was like, right.
Maybe. Is he right or am I wrong?
Okay. I was like, okay, how am I going to debate this? So I said, hey, well, and I do this kind of for sport, you know. It wasn't a confrontational debate. And this is kind of how I find these things kind of interesting. So I said, hey, okay, well, you know, then if that was the case, all the pilots would have to know about this. Like, the pilots would have to know it's flat earth and they're keeping it a secret from everyone else. He goes, yeah, they know about it. I was like, okay, I'm not sure we're going to be able to have a debate here. But sorry, to your point, you know, let's call that one a fact. But I was at a trust and news and media around when Trump was rising, actually. And it was an FT summit in New York, and it was around trust and media and why it was declining so much. And at the time, trust and media was at about 20%, which is an all-time low. And I don't know where it is now. And this guy from CNN was up there, and there's another guy, I think he was from Reuters, up there, and they were saying, we report the facts, we report the facts. And I've read so much news. You know, I'm an engineer. I have to build a system to try and figure out, you know, is this thing real or not?
Mm.
And I've read so much news. I read it from one side, the other side. I don't care about the politics. I'm just trying to figure out if I can build a system to figure out what's actually going on. And all of this news was just so contradictory to itself, depending on who wrote it. So I put up a question on the, and you know, I respect Reuters. I was the editor of Reuters. And I put up a question on the Slido thing. I said, define a fact. What is a fact? Is it a scientific fact? Is it a biblical fact? Or is it a widely accepted opinion? And the guy hit him with the question and he goes, tough one. He goes, a fact is something you're willing to correct if you get it wrong. I was like, no, it's not. That's not a fact.
Mm.
And, you know, I think when you get to the why trust in media has dropped, it's ultimately there are perspectives on what's going on and people take different perspectives. And we see this in media and some take more extreme perspectives than others. But there are very few things that are absolutely true.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish business who grew from one idea to become world-class companies able to compete with the very best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to becoming more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. And if there's one thing that entrepreneurs want, aside from more money, it's more time. The local enterprise offices want to give that back. Their supports for competitiveness and productivity can help your business save time, money, and energy. For them, it's all in a day's work. So if you want to give your business the gift of time, decreased costs, and lower electricity bills, then go to allinadayswork.ie, take 2 minutes to fill out the form, and let your local enterprise office handle the rest. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy. So, in a couple of weeks, on May 21st, I'm hosting the Retail Excellence Ireland Retail Retreat in Dublin. It's Ireland's largest retail conference, with speakers such as Michael Corcoran, old friend of mine and ex-head of social at Ryanair, and a special guest I can't reveal, but here's a clue. He recently led Ireland to big success in the rugby field, and he's an expert in managing winning cultures. You can figure that one out. Visit retailexcellence.ie to grab a ticket, and I'll see you there. So you then decided to use kind of all that kind of knowledge and insight and systems thinking that you'd learned from news and then start applying it to the financial markets. Would that appeal to the engineer in you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, to be honest, that was just more an interesting side project that I've been looking at. It was really how to try and understand if we can kind of get true factual content. But in the financial markets, what we're doing, just like we were doing in Newswhip, is to understand the response to content, wherever it comes from, we don't care. They use Newswhip, anti-fake news groups use Newswhip to detect content that could destabilize governments, that has been used to manipulate democracies and so forth. And, you know, what matters is not that there's a fire, but that there's smoke coming from it. So if you see 10,000 pieces of, or let's say 100 pieces of viral content that are fake, or you deem to be fake, or clearly malicious, then you're going to start with the one that's currently going viral. And that's what these bodies try and do. They try and hit nerve points that spark strong emotions that cause people to create content to go viral. And the same type of reaction we see in markets, which is there's just certain content that causes people to be much more concerned for a company than other content. A recent example might be a door blowing off a Boeing jet.
Yes. Yes. So what kind of content moves the markets?
Many different types. So the first thing you can look at is ultimately, is this content spreading? So you can take an aircraft accident. Again, this is something you can be quite empirical about. And it's kind of crude, but like ultimately that door, and like nobody died, you know, and I'm sure doors blow off all sorts of transport devices all the time. And, you know, but it caused a huge, huge problem. And you could have, there was, like, if you take the MAX 737 crashes, you know, they had huge problems for the stock. But there was actually two more plane accidents of the 737, not of the new one. One was in India, and there was one, I think, somewhere else, it might have been Indonesia, around that period of time. And, you know, it didn't go anywhere. And that's probably because it wasn't the new jet or whatever, you know. And so one of the things that you can do is you can measure ultimately, like, what is this news impactful? Like, how many people are getting involved in it? But all types of news can move markets. It's just, really, it's crazy. It can be really small things. Change of CEO, earnings, like most market news is expected. Earnings news, big announcements from central banks, and then there's unexpected news. That would be stuff like doors blowing off jets or product flops or whatever. So there's this kind of cycle of anticipation around content, and then there's the kind of reality that plays out.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There is that the first point is it spreading? That's really interesting. Yeah. Not as if is it a fact, but is it spreading?
No. I mean, it's like the online advertising platforms. They're more concerned with eyeballs, and so in terms of content, I think Paul, the co-founder of Newswhip, had a great comment. He was asked on Bloomberg, and he said, "There's a saying we have, which is a lie can get around the world before a fact can get its boots on." You know, and you know, it's just, you know, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, you know. So it isn't always true, but there are definitely scenarios where it happens.
Yeah, and it seems to be getting more pronounced, because you see this quite a lot in terms of things go viral and then go hyper, hyper, hyper viral within 6 hours, and then they prove to be disproved. You know, it's actually not correct. What does that mean for a stock price? Because obviously the markets are open, you know, and it's moving. What does that mean for a stock price then? Because you often see like a rebound real fast. Is there people monitoring the markets 24/7 looking for, doing kind of the opposite of value investing? They're like looking for the dip that is incorrect. So is essentially that what you're helping them to spot?
Yeah. Most people do that with price. So again, a good example is, you might have heard the Volkswagen. There was a press release last April Fool's about Volkswagen, and it was, I think it was something to do about them like pivoting into a new EV or something like that. It was an April Fool's Day joke, but the market caught on to it, and the stock price, you know, I can't remember if it tanked or rallied. So, you know, these type of things do happen where, you know, incorrect content, you know, hits a stock price. You have even bodies that focus on generating research in order to kind of short sell a stock. There's a good book. I know you talk a lot on this podcast about books, and one of them I was thinking is good is How to Make a Few Billion Dollars by Brad Jacobs, I think his name is.
Yeah, I've really seen it, but I haven't read it. Is it decent?
Worth a read, and very easy to read, very quick. Really, really positive. Loved it. But yeah, he was, I think it was XPO. They were a distribution stock company, and he was the CEO, and they got short seller research, some sort of, he doesn't go into much detail in the book, some short seller researcher group tried to spike their stock price by writing negative content, which turned out to be untrue. So, I mean, maybe if it's true, it's okay, but maybe if it's not. And they had stacked up a short position against them in order to profit. And the market, their stock price tanked. But he knew it wasn't true. So he rallied together a load of people, put together, I think, a couple hundred million or $1 billion to do a share buyback at the discounted price. And then the market realized it wasn't true. And within a week, they'd made like 3 or 4x or something, some massive amount of money. So I think that was his fastest way he made a few $1 billion. He made it a number of different ways, but that was one of them.
Yeah, it really does feel like we're in a very interesting time in the world, both financial markets and news-wise, because it really feels like there's a tipping point, because everything's available 24/7 now. You know, it used to be like, I was reading, I was doing an interview with Bill Ackman there last week on Lex Fridman, and, you know, they were talking about kind of newspapers, and you used to get your news from newspapers, you know? And I was reading... Morgan Housel was writing about like the dissemination of news in terms of like it used to be like, you know, a farmer in Iowa wouldn't know what a guy in New York was doing until he got the newspaper and he'd open it up and he's like, oh, in New York, this happened yesterday. There was a fire or there was a new mayor elected. Whereas now it's like we are just drinking from the fire hose of rapid information and often just overwhelmed by it.
I'm calling it Oppenheimer for markets. Like, we're splitting the atom.
Do you think it's completely that different? You think we're at a brand new era?
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. And I'll explain to you why. For exactly what you're saying, you know, you read any trading book from the old ones to the new ones. I mean, the idea of short selling came from the Venetian markets, where they had... they used to pay... guys with the best telescopes to sit up on top of the market square. You know the story. And they would look at the boats and they go, that boat's full of coffee. And then they would whisper down to their coffee friends and they would drop the price because, right, get the coffee out now. We're going to have a lot of coffee in it. And I've thought about this so much because if you think about it, what's going to happen on that market is the other people selling coffee are going to drop the price as well. And I find this so interesting as to how the price wraps up the information. So even if they used to pay these telescope guys a lot of money, but still the information probably got through the market pretty quickly, like the amount of advantage that they really had. I mean, you know, so the information soon must get around the price, because you could also just pay a runner kid or something to go around and find the price of all the coffees in your market, and if somebody's dropping them real quickly, then realize that there's probably coffee coming. But all in any trading book, as I mentioned, it's every time they say news, you know, even in flash boys, even in the high frequency stuff, when unpredictable stuff happened, maybe something happened in the news, it was always this nebulous, unknown world that they just couldn't quantify. And most of it wasn't quantifiable prior because it was written in these physical papers and people were reading them at different times and so forth. But now it's completely quantifiable and the amount of information is unfathomable. Like we burst up to detecting 60 articles a second at times. And if you think a trader can ever go through that amount of information and understand how it's going to impact the stock market, which is also priced, you know, in milliseconds, but we price it minute by minute, you know, the amount of data that is being, that needs to be chugged through is monumental, and it's beyond a kind of human capability. But as I said, all along, they said that news was this major driver, but it just hasn't been possible to really correlate those two things. And that's what we're doing. We are splitting the atom, and one side of the atom is the information that drives the market, and the other side of the atom is the price reaction.
It's a fascinating intersection because, again, I was reading a book during the week, and they said, like, once in a million events happen every day now. It's just we hear about them. They've always happened. Yeah. They've always happened. I was fascinated by this. It was something I thought about a lot in terms of, is there more weird stuff happening in the world? Or are we just more aware? And it's just that we're more aware because we hear something happening in Ghana, something happening in Australia, something happening in Singapore. And we'd never hear that before. Like once in a million things happen every single day in the world. It's just that we now have access to that information.
Well, if you think about it from a high level, pretty much every person has like the best recording device on them that ever existed in the history of mankind connected to immediate internet. Connected to immediate social connections. You know, it's like if there was hundreds of thousands of journalists, now there's potentially billions. Mm. So, you know, and when you talk about one in a million, I mean, the odds of a viral story is so low. It's somewhere between 1 in 10,000 and 1 in 100,000. Obviously, we model these types of things and we use the mathematics of plane fault failures, like the device failures in airplanes that they use to make sure that it's incredibly unlikely, because that's how unlikely it is that a story goes viral. It needs very particular components, but it's still just really unlikely.
What are the characteristics of a viral story?
I mean, you spoke to Mark Little about it. It's just to step up above the noise. It's an emotional vector. It's something that, it's just like advertising. Advertising tries to encourage you to have some sort of emotional thing because that's what actually drives you to act. And in terms of acting on social media, why do you decide out of all the articles that you read in one day, why do you decide to share one of them? And why does someone who reads that again decide to share it again? And it resonates with an emotional. Sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's humor, sometimes it's, you know, it can be any one of them, really. Anger is a pretty powerful one. Mm. And guess what markets are? Markets are driven by emotions. It's the same thing.
Yeah, it's funny. We think we're all like these rational, calculated beings, when in reality, it's exactly like you say, we're driven by emotion, whether it's fear or anger or greed or whatever it is. We're driven by the innate things, as rational as we are. And it's like you made a great point there. People just can't process all this stuff. It's just, no. It's too much for people to process. So kind of like you've built on that with NewsWhip and now with BreeMind. So bring me back to the kind of early stages of NewsWhip. Why did you guys set that up?
The story goes from before that, actually. I had another startup. So I did a degree in engineering, a master's in management science. I was always kind of fiddling around with stuff. I remember back today, we built a thing in college called Bebo Hitter. Me and my cousin, when we were drunk.
Bebo Hitter.
Yeah, it made me look more popular.
You and Zuckerberg had the same idea. What did it do?
It was really crude. It took me 2 days to write it. I was just messing around in college, and it basically just, I noticed that if you had a Bebo profile back then, the number of hits on the profile was kind of like your popularity measure. It's okay. Kind of like how many friends or likes you had now. But it was just the number of web hits it had. So if you just kept on hitting it, it just increased it. And so we built this little piece of software to do it, and you could download it. And we had this profile, had no friends, and had like 2 million hits or something like that. I couldn't believe it just kept working. We just kept running it, and like we'd go out drinking again, as you do in college, and see the number just keep stacking up. Yeah, I don't know. You know, I've just been kind of messing around with things. I actually did meet Michael Birch many years. There's a funny picture of me when I tell him that I was the guy who built that.
No way. And he heard about it
in Dublin. Oh yeah. Thankfully, he didn't hit me. Oh no, he knew about it. It was actually quite a problem for them. I mean, look. Because it was just like smashing the servers, right?
Okay, they were getting consistent requests every couple of seconds. Yeah, for new serve.
Eventually, they figured out some way to stop it. I mean, this was like before like reCAPTCHA and all that. Like we were just mucking around. So anyway, I that was when I was in my master's. I had too much time on my hands. I think Bebo Hitter stopped after a couple of weeks. They figured out how to stop us. But I went then and went for work for Accenture, and then decided, no, you know what, I'm going to give the startup thing a shot. And my first go was a company called Easy Deals, which was a location-based deals platform. Started that in about, I think it was 2007. It was around the big financial crisis. And like a really kind of basic idea, but one that wasn't really thought out and focused on the Irish market, which wasn't really that smart. I should have learned the big market lesson then, but you know, I got a taster for it. And that's where I met Paul. Paul, who was co-founder of NewsWhip, he had a news website. He was looking to bring Gawker from America back to Ireland, kind of style. And ultimately, we'd made the same mistake, which is to think that the internet market in Ireland would be large when it wasn't. And online advertising rates were plummeting as they continued to do so. So it was becoming really, really hard to survive in that world. And we'd had a conversation, and I said, listen, Paul, we were kind of acquaintances. I said, supposedly, I'd kind of forgotten about it. I said, you know, you got to figure out how to rank content, not how to create more of it. This is too much of it.
Mm.
And so he asked me out for dinner then a couple of months later, and he pitched me the idea of NewsWhip. And I was like, I think that's a really good idea. Of course, we were going after consumer web play initially because we didn't know any better.
What do you mean?
It was a website and an app where we showed all the top news.
So you were going to collate all the top news together for people to read on your website, yeah, or app. Okay,
just viral, like what was going viral. You know, we didn't make the news; we just measured it. It was quite popular, but again, it was just it's just impossible to make money with online advertising. And probably would have been a conflict of interest maybe from where we're getting the data, given that ultimately the social networks are online advertising, but we never even got that far.
Mm.
But what we did notice was that journalists were obsessed by it. And so we started building more powerful tools for them to monitor what was going on. And that's where NewsWhip, then we went completely B2B SaaS and down a professional angle.
How did you pivot that though? Because how did you have that realization that this isn't working? Because I think a lot of people just keep plowing on, thinking they can like reinvent the wheel. How did you kind of figure out going, this ain't working?
The gun was put to our head, quite simply. I'll never forget it. We had 6 months before we were going to run out of money. Investors said, if you don't figure something out, we're going to kill you.
How much did you raise at that point?
Oh, maybe 150,000.
Okay.
So I built this kind of like pro version of the website, which was pretty much exactly the same as the basic version, to be perfectly honest with you. The only difference was that you could pick how much time duration. So we would just give you the kind of top feed of social content in Ireland and different categories and stuff like that on the website. This one you could pick like in the last hour, 3 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours. That
okay. Was the only difference. So what were the journalists using the site for? To try spot kind of viral stories coming up from social?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, it was absolutely, they loved it. I mean, to understand in real time what everyone's going nuts about.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not a very easy thing. Like I said, like in the markets, all this content just flying around. Like, what does everyone care about? What do we need to cover? What's in the front of people's minds right now? Because the editors pick what goes on the front page, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's what they're reading.
Yeah.
The most read column is interesting, and that's what got Paul thinking about this. But what's social, we could give a macro viewpoint, which was not just what's going, because their analytics will only show what's popular on their website, but we could show you what's popular in the entire planet, anywhere. So,
so you figured out the journalists are using it, maybe we can sell it to them. What was the pivot point? Because I think that's really interesting for any kind of entrepreneurs listening, try and understand kind of like how to do it. Because like most first-time founders get to the point where they're like, this just ain't flying, and it's either kill it then or pivot, like you said. So how did you figure out the pivot? Really quick break to thank today's sponsor. If you've been inspired by listening to The Amazing Business Person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the Local Enterprise Office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get the idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out your local enterprise office on localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business today. Now, back to the episode.
Yep, so I had to build that very quickly. We had a pro version, which we call Spike, which is still named today. And we had contacts in media, which were helpful. So we kind of announced that we're doing a pro version. It was so hacky that we kind of, mainly because we had no way to charge them, we had a little banner on top, and it was like, put your email here if you want an extended free trial. And that kind of just dumped into an Excel spreadsheet somewhere where we were kind of like, all right, this will be our marketing pipeline, while I was building the kind of way to charge them. And then eventually when I built the kind of Stripe backend and kind of a bit of a login or whatever, we kind of pulled down the drawbridge. We'd managed to get 4,000 emails, which was great.
Wow.
Yeah, we pulled down the drawbridge. I think we were charging nothing. It was like $40 a month or something. And we got four clients.
40,000 to four. Investors. You're the engineer. You do the math on that. That's
I know.
Low.
But we just needed to prove that we could generate revenue. And that was enough for the investors. We still had a really hard round after that, but they're like, okay, we'll take this. And they weren't just regular users. I think one of them was, we got like three actual media companies out of that. Like they were users in media companies that had done it.
Okay. So like media houses or media publishers were signing off to kind of like use that for the thing.
Yeah. We sold all the media. Like we basically, I mean, from then it went, it was a pretty wild ride from then. We figured out what we were doing. I mean, we still, the pivot, you know, people say you can pivot. It kind of sounds like a pivot in a day. It took us 18 months to pivot. And we were still pivoting really probably 2 or 3 years later because our price point was wrong. And, you know, we didn't care. We just needed a price. But then we padded out the product a little bit and probably shut down the website, which I think was probably competing with our offering. And then the company started growing really, really rapidly.
Really? What was...
Yeah.
There's probably many, and we can kind of pick through this. I wanted to touch on one thing you said there, which is really interesting, because I think 90% of founders get this wrong, the price point, they go too low. How did you figure that piece out?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I think you should always aim to charge more, but in the early days, you're just trying to get some sort of traction. So, you know, you'll kind of take anything just to prove that someone's willing to pay for it, which is really important. So you got to balance these two needs. Depending on your offering, you know, I think deferred payment is a good one, maybe. Say, hey, look, you know, we're developing the product. This is our roadmap. This is where we think it's going to be in 6 months. So we would charge you this super high price, say like $1,000 a month or something. So that would be 6,000, but we'll give it to you for 1,000 because you're an early trial customer.
Okay.
I think that way you can get the best side of both the psychology, which is like, right, this is a high value product plus their discount, because they're not going to give you that money at that point because you're just too early. So, but then increasing prices, it's not the end of the world. You know, ultimately you have to, we went through, I can't say how many times we increased the price. I mean, it's $39. I think Newsweek now. Don't quote me, because God knows that my customers might be, but you know, it's a couple thousand a month now.
Okay, so that's an interesting point in itself. You didn't go from 40 to 50, you know, now you went from 40 way, way, way up. So it is possible.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a fascinating insight you give there about deferred payment, because the psychology piece is really interesting of anchoring, of price anchoring, because people will obviously anchor if you say, look, yep, 50 quid a month, that's the end of the conversation. Then they'll always anchor on the value being 50. But if you can anchor it in their head going, in the future, it will be this, then there's kind of a pathway. I think that's a really interesting point.
So two big points on this one. There's a guy called Dan Ariely. He's a behavioral... I'm just looking at the internet. Anyway, Dan Ariely, he's a behavioral economist, and he does a thing with Google, actually, where they train founders on this, and he's done a lot of very interesting experiments on exactly that. There's another one, I think, which is more critical for founders, which is what they call the Valley of Death. And the Valley of Death is basically, have you heard of it?
I've heard of it, but just explain it to the listeners.
Yeah, the Valley of Death is roughly, you either have a price point of like a couple of dollars a month and you have millions of users, or you're up around, I think it's somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 a year. And in between there is no man's land. And the reason is because if you charge someone $50 a month, and don't get me wrong, there are exceptions, but if you charge people $50 a month, they kind of expect service and you probably need a sales team. And you just can never, your CAC, your cost to acquire customer, go way too high.
Hmm.
And so basically, there's very few companies that really are in column A, the kind of $1-$2 a month. There's very few companies in Ireland even. So most of them are going to be in column B. So I think you got to figure out minimum. You should be thinking, how can I charge 10,000 a month?
That is a superb insight.
Starting point.
Yeah. Superb. And you know what? I see this a lot with serial founders. I see it all the time with second and third time founders, because they know their worth from the pricing point of view. I think it's Kevin Kelly has a superb essay as well, 1,000 True Fans, whereby he was talking about kind of, it's so good. It's so, so good. Yeah. He wrote that, I think, 15 years ago. But he was talking about, he almost kind of preempted the creator economy. And he's like, you know, in the future, you know, artists, creators will be able to have an incredible lifestyle from 1,000 true fans. But I think the B2B and the high price point is so interesting, because the kind of the early initial gut reaction is to price low and get people using it, and then they're stuck because they developed the product around that price point.
The entire media industry fell for this trap. Mm. They all went to make a huge amount of content. They thought the internet would bring their brands global, and then they would stick advertising behind it and they'd have massive audiences. But they all moved into the same place, and then they all ended up creating really cheap content and getting paid less and less money for it. And then they all had to pull out and realize, no, high value, build your audience, you know, really connect with those people.
Where do you see the media landscape now? I know you've kind of moved out of media a couple of years ago, but I'm sure you're still on it, because what do you see in 2024 as media landscape? Because I just can't figure it out.
No, it's, I think Mark Little's opinions were very, very apt. I'd say he's, you know, sometimes you defer to question. I think it's going to be a real mixture. The revenue part of the business is really, really difficult. They've had every part. You had Raina Maycock, and she was talking about when they were getting the surplus advertising for all the property in the Celtic Tiger on the radios, and that was, you know, the papers had, they had property, they had dating, they had businesses, they had adverts, they were selling the thing for $2 a day, and then the entire readership, I mean, they were just making money everywhere, and slowly but surely every part of their business got sliced away from them. Even the audience got taken away from them by the Google and Facebook, and then they're clawing that back. So where do I see it? I think Mark Little, what he said with the, you know, the kind of podcasting, the anybody can be a media brand type thing, I think that is interesting. Anyone can be a blogger and write if you write really high quality content. So I think it's going to be like niches of content. And the mainstream media, they'll continue to probably keep, they're generalist in that sense, and they'll continue to keep looking for audiences. But I mean, the reality here is it's just been brutalized, the whole industry. There was, I'm a few years out, but like I remember when we were looking at it, there was, in the period of time before I left Newsweek, there was 450,000 journalists in the US, I think, 3 years or so before I left. And by the time I left, it was about, I think it was 250,000. Yeah. Don't quote me on the numbers, but to say that, you know, the industry was falling apart would be an understatement.
It's astronomical. Where do you get your media? Where do you get your news from now?
I pay for it ultimately. I don't read the news to figure out what's going on. I read the news to see what slant people take on it. And I think that's more important. And I think it's more to understand the perspective. So yeah, I'm a big reader of the FT. I read the New York Times. I kind of stopped them, but then they got me. I like their cooking stuff, so I went back with that. Business Insider. I get. I've used my own products, like, you know, we have our own systems that have my own recommender systems. LinkedIn. The Economist used to read a lot. Basically, I kind of had to cut it all back because I didn't have enough time in the day to go through it all, really. Medium, I find quite good.
I was a big fan of Medium, and it seems it kind of fell off because Substack kind of came along, and a few other kind of like
Substack.
Gated things came along. And it seemed like it missed that window of creators. It never quite capitalized. Again, it was a monetization thing. Again, they couldn't crack the monetization piece, I think. They couldn't attract writers. They couldn't get the Substack idea quick enough, and it just kind of missed the window.
But what happens on Substack? Every now and again, one of them goes viral. You know what I mean? And you've got this kind of mad URL, and it's like, this guy's described this situation really, really well. And, you know, that. And unfortunately, I think what Medium did, and again, I'm a little bit out of it for a while, but I think as they brought up the paywall, that those things... virality and paywalls just can't really go together that well. So how do you find new readers?
Yeah, I think that's the tricky piece. Like, it really is legacy media that can only really do the paywall. I think The Currency have done it brilliantly here in Ireland.
Yeah.
They're the first people that I've seen do it really, really well at a high level and succeed at it. I think they've executed really well. Not only is the product good, I've been really impressed with their execution.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So in Newswhip, you kind of coming to the end, what was the decision to kind of like move into a new startup? Because it's tough. Why would you start another one?
Oh, yeah, I mean, God, I feel like I need my head examined, to be honest with you.
Well, I was trying to be polite and kind of go, why? Why would you do that?
I mean, entrepreneurship is kind of a disease, really. I think you've heard this from your podcast or from your people you've spoken to.
Addiction.
And the last thing you really want is to find yourself in a job. And, you know, it's like all this stuff that people crawled over broken glass for years and then they, you know, but that wasn't, it was more that I'm a technical person. I'm a real innovative type CTO. I want to be really down and dirty with the new stuff. And Newswhip's product suite was kind of built, and their algorithms were pretty much finished. And really, it was just about, you know, creating new interfaces on the data sets and maybe more strategically aligning the products. It was becoming more a product and sales company than it was a core technical company. And that's fine. It's the natural evolution of a business, you know. That's where you want to get it to. And then you want to make it sure that it can survive without you. So I also knew that it was probably going to be a good few more years before there was like a major outcome there, you know, that it was just going to kind of continue going. And I was pretty young. I was like 35, maybe 36. So I just said, you know, I could sit pretty here or whatever, but I could also just, you know, be crazy and go again.
So what did you do? Did you take some time? Were you cooking ideas? I'm always curious about... Again, serial founders is a bit of a preoccupation of mine at the minute. I'm most curious as to their logic and the thought process, because to do it once is exceptionally hard. To do it again a second time and find product market fit is really, really tough. Often easier because you have all the scars and the knowledge. But talk to me about that process. How did you even go about like leaving? And then did you kind of like take time? And then how did you start again?
Yeah, I had a couple of ideas. Everything was on the table, really. I could have gone back to employment. I, you know, hadn't really taught much. You know, my whole life was completely obsessed before with that. So, yeah, I definitely took some time off. I traveled around the world just to gather my thoughts. You know, it had been intense. You know, it's an intense period of time. So that was the first thing. Just
how long did you travel for?
4 months. It was around the world in 80 days, roughly.
Genuinely?
Roughly so, yeah.
Was that the goal?
No, not really. Probably would have.
That would have been cooler.
Time out there.
That would have been a cooler narrative.
More time out there, but what was I trying to get back for? I think I was trying to get back for Christmas. I can't remember. It was something like that. I kind of felt like I had to get back for something. I think it was Christmas.
And not to go all deep and meaningful on you, but when you're away traveling, like, what kind of realizations or any did you have?
Yeah, just you need time. You know, you need time. I do it now regularly. You need time for things to just kind of land, you know, like ideas to settle, everything to settle down. I'd seen that media was pretty broken. You know, the business models were in trouble, and I had some concepts around how we could fundamentally change that. I had the markets idea, and I've never really stuck to my own advice on this one, but like maybe just see if I could let the market guide me, and see where's the opportunity, rather than what has always been the other way, which is kind of like, I'm able to do this. This is my skill set, and this is something that I think is really cool. So I'm just going to get involved in this, which is what I did. One of the main things was, and I think a real thing for founders, I made them usually address the big market, but you know, not a like a big enough market. But VCs are already, this market isn't big enough. You guys can't get big enough for us to be excited about this. Mm. In terms of past Series A VC, like we've done some pretty reasonable rounds. And I took exception to that. You know, I thought in the early days, this business isn't going to get past this amount of revenue or whatever. And when I said it grow really quickly, I mean, we were growing at the SaaS metric of double digit growth month over month, which means you're 10 or plus percent revenue growth monthly. We were topping out up to 20%. We kept it going for nearly 2 years. And like, that's a rocket ship. That's going from like, I don't know, 1.5 million in revenue to 5 million in like 2 years, which is just like kind of chaos when you come from like charging $30. It's great though. But you know, so I was happy that we kind of proved them wrong on that one. But they also were kind of right. Like it couldn't be, you know, multi-billion dollar business. And these guys are greedy. They want the next Facebook. You know, they want something really, really big. And so that was part of me. I'm going to write this wrong. You know, if I'm going again, I'm going to go for something that's going to be really damn big.
So talk me through, what happened next? How did you go for something really, really big?
Well, I knew if I could get it. Well, again, fundamentally, I was like, if we can model behavioral reaction to news in social media, we should be able to model behavioral reaction in stock market prices. And to say that this is huge is beyond belief. I'll give you an example. Say last week, we had the CPI print report, and the number was 3.8%, and the expected number was 3.7% for the US Consumer Price Index. And because it was 0.1% off what was expected, the S&P dropped by 1.3%. It's a $42 trillion market, so that drops roughly about $500-600 billion. And that's roughly the complete GDP output for Ireland for a year.
Wow.
On point one CPI figure, yeah.
And that's just one release in one day.
To say that this information is important, you know, everybody's just sitting here waiting for it. It's, you know, you cannot really understand how much this type of stuff is driving. And that's just the S&P 500. Like our trial, Premind's trial product is trading the S&P 500. We're also testing it on another 23 ETFs. And we also have single stock ones. And the performance is very, very strong. And so, you know, when I mean Oppenheimer for markets, I mean it. You know, to say that you could make calls a market that big, but also every other ETF, every other single stock currently focused on US equities, but we are language and asset class agnostic, so we could do it in German, we could do it in Spanish, we could do it everywhere we can get the data. Maybe China would be a bit hard. We could do it in commodities, and we could have done it in crypto, but we just can't be bothered really.
So, who is this product aimed at?
For now, it's hedge funds. Like most things will start out with a kind of higher risk taker type financer. Like VC is probably one of the highest risk taker financers. So initially that would be kind of like hedge funds. But ultimately, if you can build something like this that has large capacity, which is can take a lot of money and still give good returns, then it ultimately becomes kind of pension funds and stuff like that. But you know, they won't invest in anything like this until it's really been road tested for a long time. So you'd start off with kind of people who are willing to take a bit of a risk on something that's new, because the returns are, you know, higher than they'd expect generally when trading.
So how do you build, like, that sounds like a monstrous product, like with huge ramifications. You're at it 5 years plus now?
Yeah. Well, it took time.
Yeah. What was the roadmap? Like, how did this differ from your first one? Like, how did you approach this differently than NewsWhip?
Well, you need a really good news database. That's ultimately the starting point. And that's a really difficult thing to build. That's really one of our advantages. High speed, high fidelity. And then you need all the data around, you know, what this has done in the markets. You need another really difficult thing, which is to correlate when news has caused these problems, because there's lots of things that drive markets. And then we train AI models on those examples. And then we basically run those examples into the market and take summation of all the signals. And we're calling it LMM rather than an LLM, so a large market model, which is taking signals from all different parts of the market and mixing them up so that we understand what's going on and what's driving it.
And then in terms of building the company, how did you approach that?
Yeah, well, it's three of us now. So I'm the tech, and then two co-founders, CEO and commercial. So we're still pre-revenue. So one of the hard parts about a business is that if I develop a product like NewsWhip, I can demonstrate it to you immediately. But for us to demonstrate the value of it, you know, it takes time to show that it's working in the market. So while that's going on in the background, you know, we're kind of trying to get everything else going, which is, you know, legal structures for running these things and different types of arrangements. We also have potential partnerships that we're looking at and stuff. So, you know, like a startup, you're always kind of being a bit scrappy.
So you're out of 5 years now. Did you raise cash, or how are you financing it?
Oh, yeah. One of the difficulties with an AI startup is they're super hungry on power, you know, on cloud compute. So that's a challenge. Yeah, we just raised money. Yeah.
And then in terms of co-founders, like, what was your path to that? Because obviously you met Paul through your, like, you know, your first business. So how did you then approach finding new co-founders? And did you always, were you always going to go co-founder route?
Yeah, you know, it took me a couple of months before I met Barack. Serendipity. Co-founders is a tricky one. You know, I've coached so many founders, and have you read the book Founder's Dilemma?
No.
Great book. Fantastic. And any of the people out there need to read that one. It's done by a Stanford guy. I think he was a professor who studied thousands and thousands of startups and understand what made them successful and failures. Real academic kind of angle, but well written. And the number one risk is founder fallout. And I've thought about it a lot. Like, one of the real problems is you can get feedback on something that you can repeat, and you can kind of, like, you've done 200 or 300 podcasts, so you've got probably a pretty good thing about what makes good podcasts. But you don't get to trial run founders that much. So it's kind of like getting married or something, you know, it's a one stint go. So yeah, you know, but sorry, what was the process? I knew it was a massive, massive undertaking. I'm a tech person. I want to focus very much on that. And I didn't want to get involved in the other stuff. So I just needed to find the right people who could do the other parts of the business. Because this one was actually my idea. In the case of NewsWhip, it wasn't my idea. And often it's the business person who pitches the tech person. But this is just the way this one happened.
And how did you find Barack, is it?
Purely serendipitously. We were both mentoring a founder in common. And she put us in touch. We got along. And, you know, it's kind of when you get to the kind of crux of it, you know, a lot of people might be interested in your idea, but, you know, who's really going to be able to go and do it with you? You know, are they willing to quit their job? Are they willing to change whatever? They're willing to really take that risk and put their name all over it and, have to take, the challenge of bringing their whole family along. And, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be considered when you're getting involved in a startup. So really when you get to the bottom of it, there's actually not that many people who fit the bill.
How did you know he was the right person?
Just got a good feel. We call it startup dating. You know, just you don't jump to it, but just see how it goes. Let's just start working together. Let's see how it goes. You know, if it feels right, keep going. I think, with Paul, he pitched me an idea and we just decided just different things. It's different. I don't really have a huge sample size to give experience from, but I think you just got to make a judgment call ultimately. You know what I mean? Like a lot of things in founding a business, you got to call it and live by it.
Where do you see this going? Like, where could Premon go?
I mean, again, as I say, Oppenheimer for markets. I mean, how big can it be? The S&P 500, it's a massive, massive market with huge liquidity. God, it kind of scares me, actually. You know, it's the only thing I disagree with Bobby Healy on.
It scares me how good this idea is.
No, it's not. It's kind of one of those things, like, if it works, it's just crazily kind of... I was listening to Bobby Healy at the Deloitte Fast 500 a couple of weeks, and this business will be the biggest thing coming out of Ireland if it works. I was like, no, it won't. It's the only thing I disagree with him on. Where does it go? I mean, it just becomes a massive... Well, look, here's what ends up happening. Like everything in markets, they're not static. And ultimately, we probably attract a lot of people trying to copy us. And that's why I'm a little bit paranoid at times, which you might have noticed.
Well, I went to your website and there's literally, you passed my test for like, oh, these guys are really going to be good and they've got something good, because there's absolutely feck all there to read.
I still think there's too much. Yeah.
I mean, you see, you're paranoid about the idea. Is it you're paranoid about just protecting the idea and protecting like... the knowledge of it, or what
it's
do you mean?
It's just the nature of the industry. It is incredibly aggressive, egotistical. It's have you read Flash Boys?
Yes. Yeah, really good.
Like, just the antics that some of this stuff get up to. And I'm not used to that. You know, I'm kind of like a foundry type person who's kind of like, yeah, spread the love and so forth. But you know, it's aggressive and it's intense. And
is that finance or AI or both?
No, it's finance. It's not AI, because financial organizations have historically been human-centric organizations with hierarchy. You know what I mean? Mm. Big, heavy traders, guys calling it, guys keeping secrets from each other because they know their little thing and they don't want to get copied. So they're used to this. They're used to interrogating people. They're used to hunting and dirty tricks and anything. You know, there's all sorts. And this is why I think it's going to fundamentally change this industry, because now it's not going to become a human organization world, but it's going to become a tech enabled human organization world. And the cultures really, really clash. The technology culture doesn't operate like that.
Do you see a different type of person having to be brought into the finance space, or do you see tech, are they going to become like kind of like curators and interpreters of the data, or what way do you see it going?
We'll see. You know, it's Google had this problem and they decided they were going to be an AI company, and by doing that, and this was before AI was cool, even before we were on it, by doing that they said, if we're an AI company, AI things get the highest precedent. And why that's important is because, let's say you're the top salesperson in Google and you do $350 million a year in sales or something, right, with the highest margins, and the AI team, which is a bunch of nerds over in the corner, go, right, we want to understand what drives this so we can codify this structure and make that $350 million into $350 billion or whatever. Make it span throughout the organization. That means there needs to be an openness that that person is going to say, right, come in, I'm going to share everything with you. How we do it, all the data, everything. And you can build a robot to replace me. But a lot of places, they won't do that, right? Yeah. And particularly in these organizations, you know, they haven't, you know, when they leave when they leave one organization to the other, they bring the knowledge with them and they don't want that. So, you know, Goldman Sachs has gone and tried to hire, I don't know, tens of thousands of data science engineers, but they will be completely useless if they don't have access to the data and the mechanisms that have driven the organization to be successful. It's the same in the news, you know, like there was, people have tried to do what we're doing, which is to curate news that's driven markets, and they did it manually. And I was like, if you do it manually, the computers aren't going to see what decisions those human made. You have to do it algorithmically. Mm. And so, you know, it's going to be a huge cultural challenge for this industry.
What is the state of AI in 2024? Give me a guide, because I just can't make kind of like, it's like the news flow. I can't decipher between the real and the fake.
I don't think anyone could have expected what OpenAI did. But actually, if you look at the sequence of events prior, you could have imagined it. I always start this by saying, you know, this all started from it's bi-directional LSTMs, they're called. Sorry, it's a bit too technical, but basically they're end-to-end transformers. Why that's important is because you have a sentence in one language could be 10 words, and in another language it could be 15 words. And so most AI stuff usually kind of goes on a one-to-one, but they kind of made this structure whereby you can kind of map multi-parts. And so they did this in language translation first, and the corpus, I found this fascinating, the corpus that they trained the language translation, so say English to German or English to French or whatever, the reality is that these things follow very clean rules. While they're not like, they're nuanced, they're probably probabilistic, but they're not random. They're nearly in all cases pretty much a straight rule, and there might be multiple different cases. So that, and what they did is they trained these end-to-end transformers on every single book that's ever been translated. So the amount of data that they had was just berserk. And this quality of the translation was better because they're ultimately able to get the statistical performance of all these translators over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of books. So that's where it all started. And then OpenAI took it to the next level, which was, right, if you can translate from English to Spanish, why can't you translate from English to Java? Or why can't you translate thematically, right? So if I ask you a question about football, can you give me an answer about football? And this is ultimately where LLM has come in. It's a massive model where you've got all these different translation understandings. I mean, the model breaks down very easily if you ask it about something in the news, because they're clearly not putting that information into it. So if you ask it, you know, when's the next, you know, Fed update, it'd say, I haven't been trained since April, whatever, you know, and so it doesn't have the information. But sorry, you asked me about the state of AI. I mean, this is massively impressive, and the speed at which it came out at, which is, I think, is another thing. But I do also contest with people because they kind of say, you know, yeah, I guess it's kind of a form of intelligence, but really it's just, I define it as the new paradigm of computing. Was computing before has been a logical discipline where we go, if this, then that. Yeah. If the cat is black, it's Halloween, right? And now what we have is the ability to shape these models, which, think of them as kind of a moldable wax on data sets. And then when you hit this wax with the same question, it gives you kind of reasonably nuanced answer. And so it's moving from a logical rule-based set to a probabilistic set. That's what AI is ultimately. And the implications for this in terms of computer science are absolutely massive, and probably for society as well.
So you think the hype is definitely real. How quickly do you think we're going to see mass adoption?
Oh, I think we've already seen mass adoption. I mean, they have that thing, which is the speed at which it took to get to 50% of households in the US. Internet took something like 4 years, and then mobile phones took 18 months, and and that's the tech paradigm, which is that this is consistently speeding up. And ChatGPT, I think it did it in like 3 weeks or something. Don't quote me on it, but it smashed the records. So yeah, we're there. We're already there. It's everywhere, whether we realize it or not.
What is the plan, or where do you see Premind in the next 12 to 18 months?
12 to 18 months. For where we're at now, is to continue demonstrating that we've split the atom, that what we've built works. We've already been at that 3 months. The results are very impressive. And from there, it's probably raising money, commercialization, which is my other founder. So, yeah, for me, I just make sure the systems run and the tech is good. And then, you know, like the from my perspective, the evolution of businesses, you know, I'm in early building some really interesting tech, and then we start a commercialization journey. Obviously, the tech will be updated consistently, but now the focus is on commercialization.
If the tech works, would the temptation ever be to build out your own financial house?
Oh, I mean, that definitely could be an angle, yeah. So whether we partner, do it ourselves, sell the signals, different qualities of signals, and there's interest around general market anomaly detection. So things like insider trading, or just things that are a bit out of whack, like why did this price go nuts when there was no news? We see that type of stuff all the time. Could be anything from meme stock behavior to insider trading to crazy algos going nuts. There's many examples of it. I think increasingly the regulators are you know, it's good that they're always keeping up, and they are they're looking at much more kind of real-time systems. We would make the belief that they are going to continually push for more real-time systems to monitor and make sure that, you know, algorithms aren't accidentally doing pump and dump, or, you know, that there isn't, you know, using more sophisticated algorithms to ensure that insider trading is going on, or AML, anti-money laundering, making sure that the sources of money. So all these areas constantly need to be, there's a lot of money on the line. So there's, you know, there's definitely, and there's huge consequences for cheating in markets. So, you know, the regulator continue to stay on top of all that.
It's a fascinating industry, and it's a fascinating idea. This is definitely one I'm going to watch very closely. This is I think I might have to have you back on in 2 years. We'll put that in the diary. I feel like there's a lot
of hopefully I'm not contactable.
The number you were calling is no longer in service. He is in the Bahamas. I hope so too. Just remember me when you're there. We'll do a quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
So I mentioned A Few Billion Dollars. 0 to 1 was a good one, but I think it's A Few Billion Dollars. But actually, I've decided to pick one that's probably not entrepreneur related. I just think it's a really, really great book. It's an ancient one. It's Meditations by Marcus Aurelius.
Phenomenal.
Have you read it?
Yes, it's incredible. Yeah, I went on the Ryan holiday and then went backwards. Like he's really done a lot to like commercialize stoicism and then go backwards. That's a brilliant recommendation.
Yeah.
What's the biggest thing you've learned about yourself since starting in business?
Yeah, I thought about this one. Probably unmanageable, possibly unemployable. You know,
just summed up all entrepreneurs there. That's not yeah. Not much of an insight on you.
We're just a difficult bunch of, you know, it's like herding cats. Yeah, you know, a lot of grit. You know, which is I think what all founders. When you ask me, like, how do you pick another one? This probably the most important thing is grit. Are they going to stick with it? Like, it's a long journey. And you know, that's I say Marcus Aurelius because, you know, just the stoicism, you know, you read his book and it's, you know, it's he's just looking at this whole world he has and this famine coming upon it, and he has a way of kind of just, you know, making peace with it and getting on with his day.
I think that's why stoicism got so popular as well, because founders kind of latched onto it as like, oh, I'm not crazy, it's okay.
Yeah.
What valuable business is no one building?
What valuable business? I think online advertising is kind of broken. I think there's something there don't know if I'd ever want to get into myself. I do think there's something the news industry can do to dramatically improve its revenue systems. And a final one I have, which is kind of a wacky idea. If you look at any, I was an electronic electrical engineer. So if you look at any power system now, particularly with a huge amount of renewables, the issue is variance in power. And so power storage is the most important thing, but there's just no way we can build batteries. So pumped water storage is super interesting. But if you do pumped water storage on land, it takes up a lot of space. There's a lot of planning. So like Turlock Hill and stuff like that, it's pumped water storage. So my idea, which anyone out there is welcome to copy, because it could be just completely daft. It's, I don't see why you can't do pumped water storage underwater. So you just have a kind of a tank underwater, you pump air in and let the water go out, which means it doesn't really have any construction issue on land, and you could probably build it underneath these offshore wind farms. So yeah, maybe there's something there. There's an interesting company, actually, I've been following them. I think they're going to be a disaster. Interesting, because they went viral on them. I think they've already blown it, because I'm not sure it actually works, but they went viral on Instagram. So I followed this, and their stock price rallied after they went viral on Instagram. The there company called Energy Vault.
Okay.
And the video that went viral is this thing in the desert where they have like all these solar panels, and the same problem: when you have additional power, you need to store it. And what they have is this massive construction with these huge bricks. Like each brick is probably like the size of like, I don't know, 10 caravans, huge weight things. And when there's extra power, they build this kind of, they put all the bricks up, it's like a massive skyscraper. And then when they want to release the power, so they put them really high, and then when they want to release the power, the thing goes and gets a brick and drops it. So basically, when you have additional power, you lift up this massive, like tens of thousands of tons of weight. And then when you want the power back, you just let the bricks kind of drop down. They have a system that picks the next brick down.
And I'm going to have to check that on Instagram, because I can't figure that out.
Energy Vault. Energy Vault. NRGV is the ticker, as far as I remember. But yeah.
Check that out. What would you do, Tay, if I give you 10 million euro?
Put in my strategy.
Like it. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
God, there's so many. I have so many answers to this one. I do a lot of exercise, boxing, a lot of fitness. I think it needs to be. I used to do it 3 times a week. Now that I used to have the thing, oh, you only need 5 times. As much. I enjoy it. Love it. Mushrooms, I think, are interesting. Going in and out of them. Herbal teas. I love cooking. Spending time with my daughter. You know, I think we think about things and activities, but we should maybe measure our social interactions in a day and make sure we get enough of them. So,
yeah. I think make time for that. They're greatly overlooked because we can't put a monetary value on them, but social interactions are the key. My friend actually has a performance coffee company with mushrooms. I'll get him to send you over a bag. I'll hook you up after this when we get off. I'll make sure he sends you over a bag. Oil Performance Coffee, to give him a shout out. I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can only invest in one company or person. Who is it?
Yeah, I thought about this one as well. You know what? It was between Bobby Healy and Raina, but I'll go with Raina Maycock. I think and there's probably another question around what do people disagree with me on, which I'll come to. But I think, yeah, it's a big problem. A big, big problem with social media and generally what phones are doing to children. And it's a very difficult business because there's, and so many, and it's so sad really that there's so many companies that can't be built because the VC industry or whatever investment industry we have doesn't enable them. But, you know, it is the one thing I read all over. You know, even the Chinese are quite forward. You know, we may disagree with them about so many different things, but they're actually quite forward in how they do child protection. And I think if you look in any society, you're going to see unanimous agreement that we need to stop this from happening. We need to stop young girls committing suicide because they've been on Instagram for too long, and we need to stop people being bullied and people, you know, and all the different things that can happen here. You know, kids are young and they experiment and things can go wrong. So, you know, and it's sad that there needs to be a business model, because really I think that here's an interesting angle on it that I thought about today, which is, you know, if you're a 16-year-old girl and you go to the doctor and you say, I want a contraceptive pill, either because my skin is bad or because I want to, you know, to have safe sex, they'll say, right, here you go. And they do some tests on you. And then, I don't know, next time you need it, you have to go back to the doctor and you have to go again. And they make sure that you haven't developed a blood clot or any of the risk factors. And that's because they're putting that into their body. But if we look at social media and we say, right, but there's actually a risk factor. It's safe for most people, but some people go down the wrong hole with this, you know? Surely we would take the same risk precaution, which would be, okay, well, you can, particularly between the age of 14 and 18, you know, okay, you can use social media, but you need to speak to, a child psychologist once every 3 months, just like you do with the doctor. I just think it makes sense. So there's the solution like hers. I think there's a huge onus on the government to kind of put some guardrails here as well, which I'll give to Rena.
Yeah, it's a good answer. I think phones are doing a lot of damage to us as adults, never mind kids. So I can't even imagine the impact it's would have on kids. If you start a new company in the morning, or if you had to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
It might be the other one, but yeah, maybe I'd try and solve the VC problem with entrepreneurs. I'll come back to that more when it's around the disagreement, but
we're right here now. What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with or find strange?
I think the government should make a strategy to wipe out VC. I was waiting for your reaction.
Give me more.
Well, if you think about it, right? You know how it works with match funding. Mm-hmm. We get match funding going in. Most of these funds are match funded. So the government's paying a huge amount of money here. Government's a customer, in a way. And the entire, like, everyone knows AI is going to be massive, right? And whatever the next thing is going to be huge. To think that our entire innovation system kind of sits on, maybe in Ireland, there might be 100 VCs or 200 VCs, to make a decision with 100,000 to kind of enable someone to go forward, and that our whole innovation economy is reliant on that. I'm not blaming the VCs, but the only way you can describe this is a bottleneck. And it's stopping us from going forward. And in Europe, we're the ones who are suffering the most from it. You know, in America, they have a very more successful market system, so the VC mechanism works better. But actually, even again, if you break down most of the major innovations, a lot of them have been backed by governments. Like, California government was massive in Tesla, you know. And in China, they're doing the exact same thing. You know, the government's going, right, you're going to do AI, make it happen. So, you know, if it's the future of our economy that we're battling for here, which is the innovation, that you're trying to tell me that we create a roadblock with a couple hundred people? No, we have to dismantle this. That's, you know, it's not their fault, but it's how it's happened. And so we have to figure out what, you know, you speak to founders and probably 90% of what they're talking about is how they manage to convince someone to give them money to go forward. It's just a monumental waste of time.
Mm. And it does roadblock, like you said, it roadblocks so much.
In company, I spend all my time talking to founders about it. We need to fix it. It doesn't work. Let's admit it's broken.
What's one thing you spend money on that brings you immense happiness or joy?
Food and beer, maybe.
Any particular types of food?
I love cooking. Yeah, I've gotten more into it. Good quality food, you know, just experimenting with different foods and enjoying meals. And yeah, the odd beer. It's simple things in life. It's simple things. Food, exercise, social connections, true friendships, true family. That's what it's about. Everything else is a distraction. And, you know, it's the stoic. Sometimes founding might bring you to that. But, you know, you got to really pare it back. And I went through a whole period of just paring it back. And I do it with everything. It's simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. What do I need to do to make this business successful? What do I really enjoy? Just bring it. Don't complicate it. Keep it simple.
Mm, 100%. I think it's as you get older as well, you kind of start to realize that. You kind of try collect all the things when you're younger because you think that's the answer. And then as you get older, you realize, no.
Simple, it's all distractions.
Simple, simple. What's your one final piece of advice for every founder or aspiring founder listening?
Whenever I speak, I've spoken to so many founders and advise them at different, and I do the Einstein thing. Einstein says, if I had an hour to solve the problem that solves the world, I'd spend 55 minutes discussing the problem and 5 minutes solving it. So whenever I speak to a founder, I spend 55 minutes trying to talk them out of it. You know, you got to really, you know, there's a cycle to this. The number one risk is burnout. What happens is you're super excited in the beginning. Let's do it. You're pumped. And year one, you're still pumped. Year two, starting, you know, the reality drops in about year two, I think. And the thing about it is, it may not be over for years or decades. I mean, I remember saying it to my brother. He was like, we're really struggling with VC. And I said, Simon, there's an element of just whoever stays alive sometimes gets it. I was like, it was 7 years as an entrepreneur before we got anywhere. And I was on my second startup. I said, when you think about it, how many people quit after year one, year two, year three, year four? Who's left by year seven? And even still, I wouldn't say NewsWhip's a great success. There hasn't been a major outcome for me yet. I'm probably year 15 now. Who's still on the pitch? So get ready for the long haul. This is not a shortcut. And if you really want to do it, so I spend 55 minutes trying to talk them through that. Then I spend 5 minutes trying to say, okay, you're going to do this? All right, this is what you need to know. This is how it really operates.
Nice. I think the founder world needs more people like you, because there's a lot of hype merchants, a lot of coaches, a lot of advisors spewing nonsense because they're getting paid. They're on the gravy train. Whereas I think the world needs more founders like you going, right, here's the realities of it. Thinking decades, not in like 12-week sprints. I think that's really, really valuable advice.
It's worth them seeking out. I think it's worth them seeking out. Founders will help other founders. It's a really tight network. We've all been through it together. That's why I knew pretty much so many people on your podcast. And it was so interesting to hear all their stories, even though I knew the stories as well. But so they'll help each other and they stick together. So reach out, get the advice.
I always say at the end, you know, where can people learn more about you and your company? But with you, it's like, don't come find us.
No, do. There's a lot in your podcast as well. People saying go for the no. I can't have no time for time wasters, and it's mutual for them as well. Like, don't waste your own time. Don't waste our time. Mm-hmm. But if you're genuinely interested in what we're involved in, find me on LinkedIn. And if there's a spark there, we go. You know, I'm not going to close off to the world. I'm not that, oh, we're in dark beta or whatever. We're not telling. No, I'm here on a podcast to tell you exactly what we're doing. But if you know, once somebody who's interested, this what excites you, get involved. But you know, come. So yeah, LinkedIn is the best place to find me.
Perfect. Andrew, that was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed that one. If you did, do me two quick favors. Hit like on the video and leave a quick comment. It really helps the channel to grow, especially when it's a small channel like this. If you enjoyed that kind of content, click here to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And click here to watch a brand new video right now. I'll see you back here next time.